Continuing the book of Deuteronomy, we're actually within a few weeks of being finished with our study through the book of Deuteronomy. We're in the last few weeks of that. Today we'll be looking at chapter 32. Chapter 32 is titled The Song of Moses. And in these final chapters, we see really Moses' final words of exhortation to the people of Israel before they enter the promised land, and Joshua becomes their leader at that point. Now, in chapter 31, the last couple of weeks we spent in chapter 31, we saw that Moses was exhorting the people and exhorting Joshua as well to be strong and courageous as they entered the land and seek to believe God's promises and obey Him. And he says, you can be strong and courageous primarily because the Lord is present with you. He is with you. He goes with you. He goes before you. Therefore, you can be strong and courageous. He also says that it's because of the written book of the law that they have, the book that Moses himself has written, the first five books of what we would have the Old Testament. At that point, it was the whole Bible, but they had that. They had the books of the law. They had that written book that they were to learn and to become familiar with and to obey it. And then God gives Moses one other thing to encourage the people, to help them. And that was in chapter 31, verse 19. God told Moses, says, write this song for yourselves and teach it to the sons of Israel. Put it on their lips so that this song may be a witness for me against the sons of Israel. So the song that he was to write really turns out to be something of a national anthem for Israel. Not that they still sing it now. But at that point, it was supposed to be something along the line of a national anthem that they were supposed to learn and pass down from generation to generation. And that song is what is chapter 32, verses 1 through 43. And that's what we're going to give our attention to this morning. The song was given to encourage the people in their relationship with the Lord. It was also given to warn them about unbelief, disobedience, rebellion against Him. And what we also see, especially near the end, we see actually an encouragement, a hope, for God's work continuing with Israel, but even beyond just what's going on with the nation of Israel. Now, because of the length of the song, we're just going to read it as we go and look at the different points as we go. We'll start with verses 1 through 6. Give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distilled as the dew, as the droplets on the fresh grass and as the showers on the herb. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are just, a God of faithfulness and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. They have acted corruptly toward him. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is not he your father who has bought you and has made you and established you? First truth that Moses wants the people to be reminded of is that God is completely faithful. He's a rock. God is completely faithful. He's a rock. In the first couple verses, Moses calls the people to listen closely to what he has to say, because this song is an important song. As we get to the end of the song, you're going to see the same kind of thing. Verse 47, for example, I mean, he's saying, this is your life. This is your very life. As an individual, as families, as a nation, you've got to know and remember what this song says. And then he gives them a helpful picture about what his teaching through this song is like. He said it's like rain as it falls on grass. He said it's like the dew as it lays on the grass and the vegetation. And the idea there is, of course, the rain and the dew. The grass and vegetation need that water to grow. And so what he's saying here basically is if you'll listen and if you'll apply what you hear, you'll grow. You'll mature. You'll be better established, you know, if you'll listen and pay attention to what I'm telling you here. And so the first thing he begins to emphasize to them is the character of God, especially the greatness of God, the faithfulness of God. And he says in these things, and He says in verse 3 that these are things that prove God, that he's going to list, that prove God to be truly great and truly worthy of their trust. Now, a quote here by Matthew Henry points out an interesting fact about the things that Moses chooses to include and also the things he chooses not to include in these first couple verses about God's greatness. He says, "Now when Moses would set forth the greatness of God, he does it not by explaining his eternity and immensity or describing the brightness of his glory in the upper world." Now all those things are truly aspects of his greatness, but that's not really what Moses is focusing on here. "But by showing the faithfulness of his word, the perfection of his works, and the wisdom and equity of the administrations of his government. For in these his glory shines most clearly to us." So what he's saying here is the things that Moses is focusing on are really things that they can see happening, that they can look back on their history and see that God has done and see what he's doing presently and also be encouraged about what he's going to do in the future. And really those last few phrases of that quote really tell us not just about the greatness as talked about in these first few verses here, but really through the whole song. Because through the whole song, we see the faithfulness of God's word continuing all the way through. Through the whole song, we see his wisdom, I like that phrase, and the equity of his administrations and of his government. And so we're going to see, really, as we go through, how those kind of things are played out for us and illustrated for us. And once again, give us reason to ascribe greatness to him. In verse 4 there, when he's describing the greatness of God, God is first described as a rock. Now, this actually is something of a theme through the song because the idea of God is, or well, not just God as the rock, but God is the idea of the rock really shows up 6 different times in this song. I'll just kind of mention for you briefly. In verse 15, it talks about God being the rock of salvation. In verse 18, he's the neglected rock. He's the rock who gave them birth, but he's been a rock that's been neglected. And in verse 30 and 31, it's mentioned a couple times there, and it's talking about God as the rock and comparing what other nations have that they would call little r rock, which really cannot be a refuge for them at all, like God, the capital R rock, can be and is. So there's a comparison and a contrast between God as a rock and pretend rocks or artificial rocks that are not real. In verse 37, he speaks of false gods, which would be false rocks that people seek to take refuge in, but it doesn't work. So there's a theme here, really, of God being the rock. And the idea of him being a rock, especially, he mentions here, his work is always perfect. It's always done exactly as God decrees it to be done. There's nothing left out. He always completes his work as he intends. His ways are just. All these, the idea of firmness here, the idea of stability. His ways are just. He is faithful. He is upright, meaning righteous. I mean, we can have a certainty about God because he is a rock. And because what is right with God and what was right with God then and what is right with God now are still the same things. It has not changed. There's a consistency, a stability with God as being the faithful rock. Things that are right and wrong do not evolve with the culture as far as God's concerned. Now, there's also a contrast in these first couple of verses with God's perfection versus the imperfection of the people. In verse 5, the people are described as corrupt, perverse, and crooked. Well, that's never going to be true of God. God is not going to be corrupt, perverse, and crooked. He's firm. He's upright. He's straight. So we can trust him. Can't always trust the people. And he's making a comparison down. But we can always trust God because of the greatness and the faithfulness that is there. So he is a rock, so we can always trust him. In verses 7 through 14, we have another aspect of God's character that's laid out for us. And I want to sum up the phrase, and then we'll look at the verses. God is a redeemer for a sinful people. So, first off, he's a rock, and now we're going to look at him as a redeemer. And in these verses, as we read verses 7 through 14, we're going to see how Moses is really playing out in kind of in very descriptive language in much of it, the idea of how God chose the people of Israel to be his own. So verses 7 through 14, it says, remember the days of old, consider the years of all generations. Ask your father and he will inform you, your elders and they will tell you. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of men, he set the boundaries of the people according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. He found him in the desert land, in the howling waste of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, he spread his wings and caught them. He carried them on his pinions. The Lord alone guided him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, and he ate the produce of the field. He made him suck honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, curds of cows and milk of the flock with fat of lambs and rams, the breed of Bashan, and goats with the finest of the wheat and of the blood of grapes, you drank wine. So Moses reminds them that out of all the nations of the earth, the Lord chose the people of Israel as his portion, as his allotment. It says they're the allotment of his inheritance. Now back a few chapters in chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, Moses talks about why God chose Israel. I want to read verses chapter 7, verses 6 through 8 here. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So there was nothing special at all about Israel or about what God foresaw Israel to be. It was all based on his love for them. It was totally due to his love and mercy. And one thing it mentions there, when he talks about his choosing them and redeeming them out of the house of slavery from the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. But when we go back to chapter 32, that same theme ties in here, because in verse 10 now, after he's talking about Jacob or Israel is his allotment, his heritage. In verse 10, it speaks of God finding Israel in the desert, in a howling waste of wilderness, and then caring for him and guarding him like the apple of his eye. Now, once again, that's probably a reference to that, to the slavery in Egypt. You know, found him in the wilderness, found him in the place of the desert, and actually cared for him and guarded him. So there's that same connection there. And once again, it's talking about how God redeemed Israel from slavery and delivered them. Verse 12, you got another interesting picture. It's the picture of a mother eagle in her nest watching over her babies, her eaglets. And it's the idea that this is what God did for Israel. It says he has a nest, but there comes a point where he stirs up the nest. As I understand, I was an eagle in another life. Kidding. But as I understand, what eagles do is that there comes a point when the eaglet gets big enough and they want to begin to kind of push it out, they start taking the nest apart, little by little, pulling it out so it's not quite as comfortable. That's stirring up the nest because it wants to get the eaglet out of the nest. So he says he stirred up the nest, he hovered over the young, and actually, a lot of times when they'll even push them out, and the eagle sometimes will come under and let the eaglet land on its wings. Then let it go again, all these kind of things, kind of teaching it to fly. That picture is what God says. That's what I did for Israel. That's what I've done for you. You know, I made things uncomfortable to push you out, to get you going. But I watched over you all the way. I was with you all the way as an eagle would watch over her eaglets. In verse 13, and it also says there that no foreign God can take credit for that. That's something God, the true and living God, did. No other little g God can take credit for what's happened with Israel, only the one true and living God. And I'm not going to go into this, but in verse 13 and 14, Moses gives just very poetic descriptions of just God's lavish provision for Israel, and just how he's taken care of them and so much because they are his chosen and redeemed people. So God revealed himself as a rock, and also as a redeemer. And God's not changed, as we said. I mean, that's part of being a rock, is the consistency there, the faithfulness there. God continues to be a rock for us. He continues to be that stability and faithful for us, no matter what's going on around us. We always need to have that understanding of God being a rock. And He also continues to choose and deliver a people who do not deserve to be chosen or delivered. He continues to choose people who are sinful and helpless to take care of themselves. He continues to do that. And gratefully, I mean, God's chosen, you know, to have a people that would be His, that would be His church. People that can really be better described as being sinful and helpless, but God is that Redeemer, and He still does those kind of things. Now, the next verses, all the way to the end of this song, really focus more not on God as a rock, even though that's, of course, that's assumed here because of the justice involved. We're also going to pick up some aspects of Him being a Redeemer at the end as well. But now it's going to focus on primarily Him being a judge. And so the rest of the chapter, really, especially, that's the theme. Judgment is the primary theme of the rest of the verses. So point number three is this. God's judgment towards sin is a certain reality. The people were sinful. They were going to continue to be sinful. And because God is upright and just, that sin is going to be judged. There's going to be consequences to pay. He's given them all kinds of warnings about the blessings and the curses already. And once again, if they will not do what God calls them to do, believe Him, obey Him, then curses are a result. And that's an aspect of God's judgment. So it gives us several different insights into the people's sin and also into God's judgment. I think some things that are very helpful here. The first one is this. Sin is a rejection of God's fatherly love and authority. Sin is a rejection of God's fatherly love and authority. This is verses 15 through 18. It says, "Then Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth." In verse 15, God calls Israel Jeshurun. This was kind of like God's pet name for Israel. It was kind of a term of tenderness, a term of affection. And so when you see that, you'll see that other places in the Scripture as well. But when you see that, it's a term of affection that God has for His people. And what He says here is because we talked about how God lavishly provided for them and prospered them. And this, once again, this begins to move into prophetic things because they're not in the promised land yet. So this song actually moves into things that they have not yet experienced completely. But because God took good care of them, they're described as those who are well fed. It says they're fat, they're thick, healthy. But instead of that prosperity causing them to grow in their love and commitment to God, who is the rock of their salvation, it says, instead they reject Him. The blessings they get, the prosperity they get, actually turns them against God instead of causing them to be more grateful to Him and more submissive to Him and more worshipful of Him. I mean, it doesn't happen that way. It goes the other direction. All the things that He provides for them, actually they use that and they actually begin to serve strange gods, He calls them. And He also says when they sacrifice to those false gods, what they're really doing is sacrificing to demons. I mean, the very opposite of God. Sacrificing to the evil instead of the good, even though God had blessed them so richly. In verse 18, it has another interesting picture. Still, you got the idea of the rock here, but it gives a picture of a rock that we usually don't think of. It says, "They neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth." We don't really think about rocks giving birth that often. But really, of course, he's expanding on what it is for God to be faithful and God to be this certain stable God and rock. And he says, He's the one who begot you. It's really kind of describing God, not just as father here, but also as mother. He's saying, He's the one who brought you into existence. You owe your very life. You owe your very existence to the God who begot you, who brought you into this world, so to speak. But Israel's response to him, he's blessed them, he's brought them into existence, and then blessed them once he's done that, he's watched over them. Listen to the different words that are used to describe their response to him. It's helpful because these words really describe sin in many ways. They are all sin, but it helps us to get a picture of sin. It says they forget him. One aspect of sin is just forgetting God. They neglect him. They provoked him by their actions. They made him jealous by their actions. They scorned him. They forsook him. They kicked against him. Those are all words that are used to describe what their response was to the God who brought them into existence and cared for them in a very lavish and very affectionate way, when he even uses the pet name for them. That's really a picture of any time we sin against God. I mean, those are things we neglect God, we forget God, we scorn him, cause him to be jealous because we put other gods in his place. Those same expressions still apply to us. And so what we get here is an aspect of sin where we're sinning against the love of God as a father and his authority as a father. His love because he's brought them into the world and watched over them, and they're sinning against that love. In spite of how they've been provided for and taken care of, they are sinning against his love. But they're also sinning against that fatherly authority. They enjoy the blessings, but they do not want to do what he says. They do not want that authority in their life that they have to obey. So they reject his fatherly love and his authority, and that's one aspect, a picture of their sin. So sin is a rejection of God's fatherly love and authority. Next, sin causes God to hide his face from the sinner, but in his mercy, he is slow to judgment. He's slow to judgment. This is verses 19 to 27. The Lord saw this and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. Then he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be. For they are a perverse generation, sons in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger and burns to the lowest part of Sheol and consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap misfortunes on them. I will use my arrows on them. They will be wasted by famine and consumed by plague and bitter destruction. And the teeth of beast I will send upon them with the venom of crawling things of the dust. Outside the sword will be reeve and inside terror, both young man and virgin, the nursling with a man of gray hair. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory of them from men, had I not feared the provocation by the enemy, that their adversaries would misjudge, that they would say, our hand is triumphant, and the Lord has not done all this. God is greatly provoked by their sin. We talked about their sin. Now we see how he is provoked by their sin. Sin always provokes God. It always does. You know, we may get to the point where we're used to it, and we just kind of do certain things because that's where we've become accustomed to doing certain things. But every time we sin, we provoke God. We always do that. It really makes us despise in the eyes of God, other if it wasn't for Christ. And the first thing it says that he does here is that he hides his face from them. This is the sense of removing from them any sense of his presence. And it's interesting because we really see like two steps here in God's judgment, and it corresponds with kind of two basic steps to their rejection of him. Let's look at their rejection. First off, what they leave off doing is they leave off their duty to God. They leave off worship. They leave off obeying his commands, being familiar with the scripture. I mean, they leave off doing the things that they were supposed to do. They omit. They just leave it off. Now, omitting something is just as bad as actually sinning, you know, against a particular command. But just leaving it undone is just as bad. But that's the first step, is you leave it undone. You don't do what God has called you to do. But then that leads to the second step, which is actual visible sin against what His Word says and going actually against it, which is a sin of commission, sin of omission and sin of commission. Well, the way God responds to them corresponds to that. His first response is to leave off His presence. He hides His face from them. He just removes and says, I want you to see what it's like. And to realize what a devoted father, what a devoted friend, what a loving God I've been to you, I'm just going to pull my presence away. So it won't be there anymore. You won't sense it. I'm going to leave it off. Then from there, if they do not respond at that point, then you have the actual judgment that takes place in bringing consequences into their life as a result of their sin. So he kind of ends, so it's interesting to see this twofold judgment. And these verses actually talk about that. And actually in verses 23, which is where he begins to talk about the active judgment, where he's bringing those curses that have been warned about in chapters 27 and 28. He's actually bringing them now actively on them. He says he will heap misfortune on them. He talks about famine. He talks about plagues that are going to come, attacks from wild beasts, the sword from other nations. And he says in verse 25 that the defeat from other nations is going to be so complete that it's not just the outside sword. In other words, it's not just the battlefield where the defeat is taking place, but they're going to be so thoroughly defeated that they're going to actually come inside. And it says the young men, the virgin, the nursling, the man of gray hair, those who are in their homes are now threatened because of the enemy, because their defeat has been so thorough. But even here, we see that God is slow to fully annihilate them. In verse 26 and 7, he holds off from totally annihilating them and removing them from the face of the earth. He says, I would have said, I will cut them to pieces and I'll remove the memory of them from men. I could have done that, he said. But had I not feared the provocation by the enemy, that their adversaries would misjudge, that they would say, our hand is triumphant, and the Lord has not done all this. He says, because I don't want these enemy nations that I'm using to defeat you, I don't want them to be thinking that their gods, their false gods, their strange gods, those gods of demons, are the ones responsible for this victory. And so he holds back and allows Israel to remain, to at least there to be some remnant of Israel to remain. Now, so what we see here is in a couple of ways. You see God's judgment, but you see His slowness to judgment. At first, He just removes His presence, and then there's actual consequences that come secondly. So there's a slowness to His judgment, which once again means it's mercy. And even here, He's slow to just totally annihilate them, totally do that. He's slow. So once again, there is judgment, but there's mercy mixed with the judgment. Now, there's another interesting aspect of God's judgment I want to focus on here. One verse in particular, in verse 21. Just read what it says. Verse 21, they have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. So he says, what has happened is they have substituted a no God. Some of your versions actually may say, the translation may be no God. Mine says not a God or not God. But actually, some of them translate it no God. What they have done is they have substituted the one true and living God with a no God. And what they've done is they've just committed a travesty, because now they've taken just dumb idols as the object of their worship. And so they're now serving lifeless idols of a no God. So God says, if you want to trust in a no God, then you'll experience God's judgment at the hands of a no people. A people that are not God's people, who do not have any commitment to Him whatsoever, the Gentile nations. And he says, God will use that to provoke them, because why would God use these Babylonians and these Assyrians to defeat us? I mean, we got our problems, but they're a lot worse than we are. He said, I'm going to use those no God, no people kind of people to really provoke you. That's another aspect of mercy kind of within the judgment to raise them to jealousy, you know, there. Now, the Apostle Paul uses this verse. He quotes this verse in Romans 10. And in Romans chapter 10, I'm not going to read the whole thing, just kind of give you the context there. He's talking about the gospel, and he's talking about the only way to be right with God is through faith in Christ alone. And he's also speaking here in the context, especially 9, 10, and 11, all through there in Romans, about how the Jewish people have, for the most part, rejected Christ. There's a remnant. Paul himself was a Jew. The apostles were Jews. I mean, there were some believers, but for the most part, the Jewish people had rejected Christ. But he says here, in Romans 10, he said, whether it's a Jew or whether it's a Gentile, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So he's bringing them, he's saying, you're both in the same basket. You know, you're both in the same situation. You both need salvation, and you need to call on the name of the Lord if you're going to be saved, whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Gentile, both alike. And then what he says here is, it's the idea of God is once again provoking Israel to jealousy by extending very definitely and deliberately the gospel to the Gentile people, the no people, as far as salvation is concerned. It's interesting. Once again, the original verse is Deuteronomy 32. The Jews seem so shocked when you get to the New Testament that God would bring Gentiles into the covenant, that he would bring Gentiles into faith. That had been promised all the way through the Old Testament, that's what he was going to do. He was going to bring these no people. He was going to bring these Gentiles. He was going to bring the nations in. That was not something new that had just happened. That had been promised all the way through, but the Jews missed it because of their arrogance and because of the self-centeredness there of seeing themselves as God's people. But quote here by John Gill, talking about how Paul used that verse. He says, since the Jews provoked God to jealousy and anger by worshiping strange gods, which plainly declared their want of faith in him, affection for him, and their departure from him, it was a righteous thing in him to provoke them to jealousy of him, if he had no affection for them, who had been so long, in some sense, a husband to them all, and as about to cast them off and to anger them by sending his gospel among the Gentiles and calling them by his grace. It's really amazing to me. You see this really all through the Bible. Judgment for one equals deliverance for someone else. So here you have judgment on Israel for their unbelief. But tied into their judgment is the gospel being offered to the Gentiles. Judgment for one, hope and deliverance for another. It both ties two sides of the same circumstance. So what happens here? Non-Jews, which I think would fit probably everyone in this room that I know of, those who are not of Jewish background, Jewish heritage, have profited greatly because the Jews rejected Christ. Because he's brought the gospel very directly and pointedly to Gentiles. He's done that to the nations, which include us. Now, we profit greatly from their judgment. Now, I'll also say this. In Romans 11, God, there is still hope for the Jews. I don't think this has anything to do with the nation as far as the geographical, political nation of Israel. But it does talk about a great revival that's going to happen among Jewish people. Not that they're going to come together as a nation, but they're going to believe in the Messiah. They are going to embrace the Messiah in multitudes. That is, once again, going to be a blessing for the world when they do that. But we see here, once again, we see some picture of how God's judgment takes place. It's always mixed with mercy. So, going back to Deuteronomy 32, we see that God continues to speak of the sin of Israel and the judgment of God. And in verses 28 to 33, we see this further principle. God's judgment is not a hidden thing, but because of sin, people are often blind to what God is doing. Verse 28 through 33. For they are a nation lacking in counsel, and there is no understanding in them. Would that they were wise, that they would understand this, that they would discern their future. How could one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? Indeed, their rock is not like our rock. Even our enemies themselves judge this. For their vine is from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison. Their cluster is bitter. Their wine is the venom of serpents and the deadly poison of cobras. Moses says here, he says, this is a nation, this is a people that's lacking in counsel. He says there's no understanding in them. If they were truly wise, they could discern what was going on here. They would, but they don't. God had a great future for them, but they have rejected God. They turn away from Him. He's turned His face from them. He brings strong acts of judgment and destruction, devastation on them from every different angle. And it says, even verse 31 says, even their enemies understand that they're in this fix because of what God has done. But it says they have no understanding. They cannot figure it out. They cannot understand why all these bad things are happening, why things are going so terribly. They just cannot see it. They do not have that discernment. They do not have that judgment. Now, once again, that's not a new thing. Sin makes you stupid. It really does. That means you can't get a degree and become very educated. But as far as really understanding what's going on, sin makes you stupid. It's amazing. I mean, and you've probably experienced it yourself in your own life, and you see it in other people as well. I mean, how you can see someone and you can see right before your eyes their life is falling apart. Their relationships are shot. I mean, they have no economic sense on what to do with their money. Just on and on and on. There are so many problems. They can't hold a job because of a lack of character. I mean, there's so many things that you see, and what they do is they blame it on their parents. They blame it on the government. We need another government program to fix this. I mean, they'll blame it on anything but them. And you can look and just say, can't you see that you're the one causing this problem? And they can't. Sin makes you stupid. That you just cannot discern. You can't have understanding about what's going on. The same thing happens on a national scale. I mean, we could make a long list of all the things that are going on in our nation that are just, I don't know what to describe it. Awful, bad, terrible. I mean, we think about just the criminal element. I mean, we're running out of place for prison. We're having to start to let people out of prison so we can put more people in. I mean, we have a nation that actually takes immoral things like fornication, homosexuality, and abortion and says it's fine. In many cases, even condones it and encourages people to engage in those kind of things. I mean, we have, because of personal and as well as national decisions, we have a debt that is just kind of beyond comprehension, just of what's going on there. Just on and on and on. We could list all kinds of things. So what are people saying? What are the majority of people saying? We need to turn back to God. No, most people aren't saying that. There's all kinds of things that people offer. This is the solution, this solution, but it almost always has nothing to do with God. They want to keep God as much out of the picture as possible. Stupid. It's just stupidity. Instead of saying it's the economy stupid, it's sin stupid. And we just don't recognize it, even on a national scale. And God is getting our attention, but just don't see it. And otherwise there would be a major turning to the Lord because of that. But that doesn't exist. It does in pockets. Praise God if that's true. But there's a lot further to go. So, once again, there's a principle here. God's judgment is not a hidden thing. He doesn't hide it. It's out in the open. But, because of sin, people are blind to what God is doing. One more thing to note on this emphasis on sin and judgment. The enemies of God and of His people will endure His vengeance and retribution. The enemies of God and His people will endure His vengeance and retribution. This is verse 34 to 43. Is it not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? Vengeance is mine, and retribution in due time their foot will slip. For the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Lord will vindicate His people, and will have compassion on His servants, when He sees that their strength is gone, and there is none remaining, bond or free. And He will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they sought refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices, and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you, Let them be your hiding place. See now that I am he. And there is no God besides me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal. And there is no one who can deliver from my hand. Indeed, I lift up my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword will devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired leaders of the enemy. Rejoice, O nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land and his people. Some very vivid descriptions. We're not going to be able to look at all of them. But the verses really seem to be focusing primarily on the judgment of the nations that God uses to judge Israel. Now, Israel's judgment, I think, is mixed in here as well. But the primary emphasis seems to be the nations, these evil nations, these pagan nations that God has used to bring on them, to bring judgment on them. Just because God has used them doesn't mean he's going to give them a pass to their own idolatry and their own wicked ways. They are going to be punished for what they have done. But the enemies of God and the enemies of his people will endure God's vengeance and his retribution. That will take place. In verse 36, it says, the Lord will vindicate his people. It's talking about how he will, once again, you have this mercy mixed in with judgment. It says he has compassion on them. He sees their strength is gone. And he openly then mocks the pagan nations and their gods that they supposedly take refuge in, which are not a refuge at all. And really, God is, in a sense, mocking those so-called no gods. In verse 39, he says, they will see that there is no God besides him. In verse 41 and 42, God gets very detailed about the judgment he's going to bring on these adversaries. He says he'll repay them, those who hate him. His arrows will be drunk with their blood. Sin and unbelief, obviously, is a serious thing to God. And all those who are enemies of God and of his people will pay the price. Now, in these verses is one verse that is quite famous. And I want to focus on this verse here. It's in verse 35. God says, in due time, their foot will slip. Now, some of you know where that verse comes from. Others of you probably don't. But as I explain it to you, you'll recognize more fully. This was the text that Jonathan Edwards used when he preached his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. In due time, their foot shall slip. Most people would say it's probably the most famous sermon that's ever been preached on American soil. And you can still hear it, not him speaking, but it's been recorded and written in multiple places. I want to share with you some of the insights, four insights in particular that he made about this particular verse, especially as it relates to unbelievers, those who are God's enemies. He made four observations. First, unbelievers are always exposed to destruction. It's kind of like, and we can relate to this well, especially the last couple of weeks. It's like constantly walking in a slippery place. You're always exposed to the possibility of falling. You're always exposed to destruction. That is always true for those who are unbelievers. It's like driveways and sidewalks covered with ice. Always exposed to destruction. Second, it also implies that unbelievers are exposed to sudden, unexpected destruction. And you know that. I mean, how many of you actually fell down because of the ice at least once in the last couple of weeks? Okay, well, I did twice. Both of them, one up here and one back here. And I've fallen down at home other times in the past, but which everybody will tell you if you'd like to find out about what that looked like. But anyway, and what's amazing to me, you've all fallen down to other times, most likely, in the past, is that even though you're being careful, every time I would fall, it was always unexpected. I mean, because I thought, I'm trying to be careful. The next thing you know, you're on your bottom. And you can't stop it. You're just there. You just fall flat. He says that's the way an unbeliever is. They are always exposed, always, to sudden destruction. Unexpected. It can happen like that. Third observation, the unbeliever is liable to fall all by himself. They're in a slippery place. You don't need somebody to push you. You don't need somebody to trip you. It's just you that makes you fall. You don't need anybody else to kind of give a hand to try to get you on the ground. What that means is our own sin is all it takes to make us liable to destruction and to eternal hell. That's all it takes. The fourth thing, the only reason that an unbeliever has not fallen already is because God's appointed time has not yet come. He says in due time, their foot will slip. Who determines that due time? God does. So the only reason that unbelievers who are God's enemies have not slipped, have not fallen to sudden destruction, unexpected destruction, is because God has chosen it. It's not time. But who knows when his time is? Only he knows. Here's a quote from his sermon. There is nothing that keeps wicked men at any one moment out of hell but the mere pleasure of God. Nothing that keeps wicked men at any moment out of hell except the mere pleasure of God. And by that he means God's sovereign will. He's not under obligation to keep any of his enemies alive even for one moment. No obligation at all. It's only his mere pleasure that there is any life whatsoever to those who are his enemies. And at any moment, their foot could slip because of their sin, and eternity in hell is the result. God's judgment towards sinners is a certain, certain reality. But once again, with judgment comes hope. And this song actually ends with a note of hope. Number four, the song of Moses gives reason for encouragement because the Lord will vindicate his people and cause nations to rejoice in the Lord's salvation. We'll pick up verse 43 again and then read some of the final verses right after the song. Rejoice, O nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land and his people. Then Moses came and spoke all the words of this song in the hearing of the people, he with Joshua the son of Nun. When Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, take to heart all the words with which I am warning you today, which you shall command your sons to observe carefully, even all the words of this law. For it's not an idle word for you, indeed it's your life. And by this word you will prolong your days in the land, which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. He ends like he begins, which is with a strong encouragement to hear the words of this song. Pay attention to what this song is telling you and take them to heart. And then he calls for rejoicing. Verse 43, he calls for rejoicing. And there's really two reasons that he calls for rejoicing here. First off, he calls for rejoicing because it says God will avenge the blood of his servants. The idea here, the rejoicing is, even though there are and there will continue to be those who are enemies of God and who will oppress and persecute the people of God, the rejoicing here is that God will avenge the blood of all of his servants. He will do that. He will vindicate his people. And those who oppress and persecute will be judged by him. It's interesting to note, too, rejoice, O nations, with the people, for he will avenge his blood. In other words, this is good for the nations. This is good for the people.